Welcome to Sharing Things, the podcast that takes a closer look at the people that make up our University of Edinburgh community. Each episode starts with two invited guests and an object, which can be something personal, treasured, or significant. It's something that unlocks a story and starts a conversation. We take it from there. I'm Richenza, your new host, conversational guide, and a final year medical student. Today, as with all this season's recordings, I'm sat at my kitchen table in central Edinburgh. In this episode, I've invited along for a chat music lecturer Nicky Moran and Doug Johnston, a crime author and journalist. Let's take a listen. Welcome to Sharing Things. So I'm Richenza, and today we have Doug and we have Nicky in our virtual studio with us today. And I think that we'll start with asking whereabouts it is that you guys are recording from.
I am at home in Marchmont. I'm in my home flat in Marchmont that I share with my husband, who is a physicist, actually. Doug, look, we've got connections already. And my two children, who are 8 and 6, and who have gone back to school last Thursday. So my life has just got a little bit of space in it again.
I'm living in Portobello, where I have now been for a long time, 15, 17 years, something like that. And I am in my loft, which is where my office is, which is where I write, which is why it's kind of gloomy and really bad sort of cladding on the wall. People can't see that if they're listening, but because it's never been done up. And it's the only place I get peace because it's got a hatch. You'll go a ladder and it's got a hatch and I can close it. So I get some peace and quiet. And my kids are back at school as well. They're a bit older, 15 and 11. But yeah, it's been a long time. I felt really bad. It was their first day, full day back, both of them, yesterday, and they had to go outside for the whole of lunchtime, and it was absolutely chucking down with rain because of COVID and everything else. So the whole school had like 1,200 soaking wet, miserable kids for the whole afternoon, which must have been great.
Well, you know what? Mine came home grumbling because they hadn't been allowed to go out for playtime for lunch. You just can't win.
No, you can't win.
I was just going to start with our first main sort of sharing things question, which is, what object did you guys bring along today?
I want you to go first, Doug. Will you go first?
Okay. Well, my object is a pair of drumsticks.
Whoa.
And you do music, Nicky, right? So
I do.
I've got a pair of drumsticks here. That's the proof. and these are specifically ProMark Hickory TX5AWs. Which I've changed recently. I used to, for a long, long time, I used ProMark 747s because that's what Neil Peart from Rush used. And when I read that as a kid in Modern Drummer magazine, that was enough for me. So I brought that because I have been a drummer all my life. It's the longest relationship I've had with anything, I think, is with playing the drums. And it's not always stayed constant throughout my years, but I am back to playing drums now more than I have in a long time for various reasons, which I'm sure we'll get into. But it was my first love, drumming, and probably will be my last.
Oh, wow. I used to play percussion for a bit and did try to play drum kit for a bit when I was much younger. But it didn't, I don't know, maybe it was that I never actually got a drum kit at home to practice on, I don't know, it didn't fly for me. I was doing some other stuff instead. But I do remember enough drumming to think about some weird words that I learnt when I was trying to play drums.
Yeah.
Doug, could you give us a triple paradiddle?
A triple paradiddle? I could get a single one. The thing is, this doesn't work very well with sound because it doesn't sound any different from a normal drum roll, but that's a single paradiddle.
Yeah. What about flam? Give us a flam.
Flam.
That's great words.
It's just that, isn't it? Or you can get Swiss triplets. I'm not really good at Swiss triplets.
Ooh, I don't know them.
Weird terminology, isn't there?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It's like a different world. I didn't even understand the description of the drumsticks you were giving us there either. So why did you change?
There used to be, they turned out to be a bit high. I'm not sure if ProMark have kept them consistent over the years. I mean, we're talking about 40 years now, if not longer. When I remember reading Neil Peart and Rush, and in that interview he said he got ProMark 747s and he shaved the varnish off the handle parts because they were too slippery. So when you're sweating, obviously it can make them a bit slippery. So that's what I did as well. I got the little blade out of a pencil sharpener, unscrewed it out of the pencil sharpener, and basically shaved away and to get the varnish off the handles. Nowadays they don't put varnish on the handles because I think there was a problem of them being slippy. So, but they turned out to be a bit heavy, or maybe I'm just I've become a slightly different kind of drummer. I don't know. But the ones that I've got are slightly lighter sticks now. But I go through loads of them because you know, I hit the drums pretty hard. So it's not the drums that are the problem, but it's the cymbals. If you hit the edge of the cymbals, it tends to. I mean, these ones are getting a bit ratty. I can't really show you very well on this camera, but they're starting to sort of crumble a little bit, and they eventually go. And the last thing you want is for them to go in the middle of a gig. So you want to always have a fairly new set when you're playing live. But yeah, but so I've kind of used anything I can over the years, but I've got back into trying to do it properly again. So get proper sticks.
Who are you playing with? Do you play with lots of different people, Doug?
Well, at the moment, it's really interesting because I'm a crime writer. I write crime novels. So my 12th novel is coming out this week, actually. But I've been in bands kind of on and off all the way from school. Kind of most seriously around the time that I was at university, at Edinburgh University, actually. I was in umpteen bands who kind of almost got signed and were gigging regularly and all that kind of stuff. But nothing ever really happened. And then I kind of fell out with it a little bit. When I had kids, the drums were just sort of stuck up, you know, in a cupboard, you know, stacked up. So I didn't really play them. But I got them out, and in the house we're in now, there's just I'm in the loft in my office, and there's just enough room to have the drum kit. It's set over right here. So if I get a bit of writer's block, I can just go over and bash the kit. Yeah. But I am in a band now of crime writers. I'm in a band called the Fun-Loving Crime Writers, which is myself and Val McDermott sings. Mark Billingham sings and plays guitar. Chris Brookmeyer sings and plays guitar. Stuart Neville is our brilliant lead guitarist. And Luca Vesti from Liverpool is our bassist. And it kind of started as not a joke. We were all at a conference in America, or some of us were, a few years ago. 3 or 4 years ago, and they had an open mic night and a house band playing them. And during their interval, we went up and just jammed a few songs, and it went down quite well. And I remember coming off stage and saying, you know, we could do this back home. We know enough people, because I had done. I also sing and play guitar. I had done acoustic things with Chris Brookmeyer and Val McDermott and stuff at various festivals, and so we kind of got a band together. And our first gig was at the Edinburgh Book Festival. 3 years ago now, and I think people came along thinking we were going to be terrible, understandably, I think, and we're pleasantly surprised. We play songs, cover versions, songs related to murder and death and crime. As it turns out, there's absolutely hundreds of them.
Have you got a good example? I can't think of any off the top of my...
No, I'm just racking my brains.
Watching The Detectives, Chain Gang, anything by Johnny Cash, Scottish murder ballads. There's loads of this stuff. So it's kind of snowballed. And we played Glastonbury last year, which was kind of crazy. And we had a whole bunch of gigs lined up for spring this year, which we had to cancel because of lockdown. Including the Queen's Hall. I think we sold out the Queen's Hall in Edinburgh. So that was absolutely cutting. But we're looking to get back into it again. But in the meantime, I'm just drumming away in my loft.
Oh, magic. That is stunning. Your performance experiences and what you've done there completely surpass the performances and performing experiences that I've managed to acquire in my life as a professional music academic. But I don't suppose that's a surprise. I mean, you've made me remember that I actually did at a time in my life used to hold drumsticks and play drums with drumsticks, and then that kind of gets, you know, superseded with something else. And I think for me, I've always been happy. There's some things that are continuous. I've played violin or viola for a long time, and that's sort of a bit continuous. But the types of music that I've played and the people that I've played with, always wherever I've lived. And whatever's going on, I've always found that the crucial thing for me is finding some sort of vibrant like music ecosystem. I want to play music with the people that I want to spend time with, and I started playing the sitar when I was studying in London for my undergraduate music degree, and that then at that point in time, like, that became the most sort of, kind of the most sort of real or authentic context that I got to play music with. The people that I wanted to play with were doing that. I got introduced.
What was it like to learn the sitar?
It was wonderful. Really, very difficult. It's a really demanding instrument. It's actually really quite physically a bit brutal on you. You know, there's lots of stories of people slicing the top of their finger off while they're practicing. And then having to carry on because it is a bit macho and butch, but you just keep playing. I love the way that the opportunities that are around you, like in music, to me, they come from the people you're with and the people you want to be with, as much as some particular sort of tradition or culture of music making.
Yeah, it's sort of weirdly. Sorry, we haven't even talked about your object yet, but I just want to talk about music. the music thing, it is a real. That's something I've come to learn. I think when I was a kid, I mean, I was just in sort of rock bands mainly, but I just took that entirely for granted. That sort of communal experience of it, I didn't consider it at all, really consciously. And you know, like any bands, we used to like fight and fall out all the time and all that kind of stuff. But it's really brought home to me, I think, with this, the current band, I think because we're all a lot older. I mean, I'm sort of in the middle of the age range. You know, Val's considerably older than me and Luke is quite a lot younger, but we're all still kind of in our 30s and upwards, 40s, 50s. And because we're all writers, you know, that's a very solitary existence. Mm. You know, you kind of sit in my dingy office and basically make up, you know, fictional worlds all day, and we all do that. And so that ability to get together and rehearse and play has been absolutely transformative in the last few years. And not just, and folks say, oh, the gigs must be great, but actually the sitting about doing nothing is brilliant as well. Like sound checking and sitting around and loading up and getting the gear out and going out for a meal and having a couple of beers. I mean, that whole thing is like easily as good as the, you know, 90 minutes or 2 hours or whatever you play on stage. And I've really come to, and what's been fascinating is that because of lockdown as well, it's really driven home how much of my social life is book festivals and book events and the band, which is a band of writers. That's about the only time I ever see anyone face to face or until lockdown. And so it's been a real eye opener actually for me. I think for everyone in the band, it's like a little gang now. So you're right, Nikki, about that. That real sense of a community that you get through just sharing that experience of playing.
Nick, will we ask about what your object is as well?
Okay, so my object is, if I start talking about it before I tell you what it is, I'm going to get really long-winded. But my object, oddly, does have, it's on my mind and it connects me right back to the to my improvisation practice, actually. But it's not a musical instrument and it doesn't even appear to have anything to do with music. So here goes. What this is, this object is a big cardboard postage box, and the post date on it is 20-something of October 1986. And this is a box of, a box of craft gear, of a box of colour, a box of just magic stuff. When it first arrived with me, for my 8th birthday in 1986, it was full of coloured felts and some paints and some paper, some beads, some modelling clay. What else did it have in it? Still, some of the original stuff is still in it. Safety pins, rubber bands, stuff for making things with. And it was one of the most special, exciting gifts I ever received. It was from my uncle and aunt for that 8th birthday, and I remember the sheer sort of Aladdin's cave treasure trove joy of opening it, and the permission that it sort of gave me to create. I'll never forget it, and obviously I've kept the box. Now the reason it's back with me now is that this kind of, it's turned up and been relevant again since the start of lockdown. Through a recommendation from a friend, I got in touch with a group of women who have a, it's called like creative journaling practice. And when someone told me about this, I just thought, I don't even know what that is. And then my sister, who does this as well, she was strongly recommending it to me. She said, Nick, it is, you just need to join in, because you will love this. And I was like, but what is it? I don't really know what you're talking about. And she said it's you work with blank pages and you work together, but you just make things and you draw things and you paint and you're guided in it. I thought, I still don't know what you're talking about, but I'm going to give it a shot. And it's turned into something so significant for me that has taken me through from really a really challenging last few months. And the weird connection that brings us back to music is that since lockdown, of course, it's not been possible to go and do regularly play music with the people I normally would, and to have that part of my life, which, because we, you know, I think it would apply in all music contexts, but for me there's something special about freely improvised collective music making, where we'd get together and sit and switch off the talk and just let comes out what comes out, let your hands do some stuff, listen and follow to, you know, pay attention to what you've produced, be listening to what's being created around you and just responding to that. And that is such, it's an incredibly special experience that for me has always been tied to music making, and I couldn't access in lockdown. And weirdly, this sort of this creative journaling, as I've discovered it, is a place where I can get a lot of that same experience back, just working with materials. And there's something extraordinary I found in this virtual setting. It was the most productive and exciting and inspiring sort of use of remote digital formats. And I was sort of discovering that at a time when I was thinking, how am I going, we've got to convert, we've got to do all our teaching, I've got to change, you know, I've got to make my courses work online only, I've got to find ways of doing my job now, which is hugely about communicating ideas and with people. How am I going to convert this? How am I going to put this online and not have this sort of dry, two-dimensional space? And then just found through these weekly journaling sessions with this amazing group of women that it was richer than many in-person events that I'd or experiences.
I'm still like you. I'm still struggling to picture. So what? How does it actually? What are the logistics of it then? This online creative learning thing. It sounds fascinating, but I can't really picture.
It's
it.
Just so it's magic. Even after putting in many hours and sessions now, I'm going to still struggle to explain it. Let's see. So the group that I work with is actually. Is a group which has got various sort of little subgroups called Maternal Journal. So it's been devised as a particular way of bringing communities of women together who have in common the experience of motherhood in some way. And it is a particular life experience that with its own demands and its own you know, its own patterns, and it's characterized by a lack of space to reflect. Its character, motherhood generally, I'd say, is characterized by a bit of a loss of oneself, because everything that you do becomes is channeled towards supporting the people around you. Obviously, I've gone right off the point from your question there, which is, but what do you do on paper? But what happens in these sessions is, you know, you might be given a prompt to pick up and to choose, like, okay, you've got a box of materials of anything goes in front of you. You might have some crayons, felt-tip pens, paints, oil pastels, bits of paper, you know, a magazine that you can rip up. It's a question of for a protected amount of time with a beautiful clean blank page in front of you, what will your hand pick up? What will you put on that piece of paper? If you pick up a pen, where will it go? So a dedicated time a chance to externalize and create something that immediately becomes beautiful because it's colorful, something that sort of reflects what's going on in your life right now. I'm still not explaining it very well. The guide, the fantastic woman who runs the sessions that she'll sort of start with to prompt people, is to to take your hand for a walk, so you can pick up any pen, any colour. You start, you put your pen on the page, and then you let it go. And every time you sort of find yourself having a little thought, you might either write down a word, or you try and keep the pen connected, or you do a little, I do a little node, I do a little scribble, and then you let it carry on again. And you say, like, do that for 3 minutes. It's incredibly sort of mindful, meditative practice. And it's just a way of, literally sort of permitting a bit of space.
I can totally relate to that. It's really interesting. Because writers obviously, famously have the fear of the blank page, and writer's block and stuff. And I was a journalist before I was an author, so I never really suffered writer's block, because as a journalist, you don't have that luxury, because you just basically get fired if you don't write, your 800 words on Bob Dylan by the end of the hour. But what's really interesting is that I do a little bit of teaching for the Royal Literary Fund on academic writing. And so often, it's usually postgrads, sometimes undergrads, but we do sessions on, trying to, because people get really hung up on things have to be perfect first time and just not knowing, they're kind of paralyzed by fear. I mean, you must see this all the time, Nikki, in academic writing, where people are just petrified of getting it right and just never do anything. Run sessions on free writing and journaling. So where people just exactly like, it's not for public consumption. Mm-hmm. It's for them to just try and work out some of their own thoughts. And it's about exactly what you have been talking about reconnecting with their own creativity. I do whole day long, workshops on, how to add creativity to academic writing, or how to think like a creative writer, because it is a piece of creative writing. Mm-hmm. And I think people forget that completely. But I think the thing you mentioned, Nikki, about giving yourself permission or space, that those things, just carving out a little bit of, and all it can be is a tiny bit of time and a prompt and a bit of paper, really. Mm-hmm. And it can be so helpful for people. And I was kind of dubious about it to begin with. But then some of the results, students were coming to us going, oh my God, that was incredible. I've written 2 chapters of my thesis since we did that workshop and stuff like that. So it's been really, it's fascinating how so many people in their lives don't think of themselves as creative, when of course they are creative and they have to bring that into what they're doing. Yeah. I think it's really fascinating.
Absolutely. And I could not agree more. And I think it's, to be honest, I think that kind of, the sort of self-flagellation and perfectionism that is the scourge of academia. I think this is, it's a really, the blocks that that are there that will stop people feeling that what they, not just sort of academic researchers and like the most sort of elite level international research that Edinburgh University produces, for example. I mean, it's done by people who have an expertise and a specialism which is, absolutely top of the game. These are people generally who are have achieved an exceptional level of understanding and finesse in their field through a sort of a personality of driven perfectionism. But that same characteristic is, it can be crippling, actually. It can be crippling in terms of mental health. It can be really bad. It can also be, I think, pretty difficult it can sometimes produce difficult relationships, among people who are always striving to defend and to critique and defend simultaneously what they're doing, to critique and defend. I mean, where does that, it doesn't leave a huge amount of space for permission to go wrong. It doesn't leave a huge amount of space to be okay with making mistakes. And yet that's got to be, as teachers, that whole side of university, the university profession, as teachers, the first thing we have to do is give our students permission to make mistakes. How on earth do you learn without that? So I think I think it's this whole process of sort of rediscovering for me this summer this box, this craft box, it's been really important for me, because it's just helped me. I've been thinking about this a lot. I've been thinking about what do I want to keep in the conversion of my teaching into a totally new format. For me, this is an opportunity.
You do use or have used Creative Day in sort of traditionally non-art areas.
It's really interesting that when I at book events, for years and years, when you get a little introduction at the start of book events, and they'll very often mention, do all the sort of book, he's had X number of books out, whatever else, he's done all these other things. And he's got a PhD in nuclear physics. And people will generally burst out laughing because it just seems so unexpected to people. And I used to get asked all the time about, how come you ended up writing books if you have this physics background? And that's predicated on this idea that, science and the arts are like at opposite ends of a spectrum, which I think is a completely false dichotomy. Absolutely. I rubbish that at every opportunity. It's such garbage to think that writing books is 100% creative and doing science of any kind or something like that is 100% logical or whatever. That's just not how it, that's just not the reality of my experience at all. Writing something like a novel is 60, 80, 100,000 words, whatever it is. It's a very famous cliche about writing books that it's 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. It's about getting the words on the page, like we talked about, that creative thing. But it's also, this vast majority of it is about rewriting, about shaping the material, about making it make more sense. I'd see it like a puzzle almost, like getting the bits of a puzzle together. And so I don't see it as very different from, my scientific background at all, actually. I see it as they kind of complement each other. Because I think the way, if you're looking at logistics of plot or character development or things like that, all of that stuff, I think, is you have to sit down and think logically about it, which is something that stems from a scientific background. It's the worst bits of creative writing in the world, to me, are the ones that, inverted commas, don't make sense because the person hasn't thought through the logistics of what it is the story is doing or what it's trying to say. And so I think, I think the science background, it doesn't seem odd to me that I would do physics and music and write, fiction, because that all just seems to be part of the same kind of creative impulse, I think.
Yeah, I agree entirely. I think you guys, there's a lot of Edinburgh music has a history of aligning with scholarship in physics, in acoustics, and of course, music as a subject, as an academic discipline, you usually find in that particular degree type, you usually find components of study of physical acoustics and sciences in there as well. And I think, to me, the overlap is there is a type of conceptual thinking, that what you're describing, that the scientific process and creative output, or especially musical output, that they sort of require. I mean, to perform and to listen to music, this is to dwell in a conceptual realm. Yeah. We all do that. We think of yourself as doing that or not. That's what happens when we listen to music. It's what happens when we engage with music. We're translating physical vibrations into meaningful patterns in our heads. I mean, I think that, to me, that's not so dissimilar from a sort of a scientific interpretation or development of thinking about the world. It's still extrapolating patterns and then being interested in the patterns for their own sake. But we're all in everyday life, every single person, every individual is a magical mix, is a blend of will to express and pragmatism and skillfulness in different areas. I mean, we're none of us is one thing or the other, are we?
We're getting quite profound now. That was quick, wasn't it?
Yeah, you both seem to be a very interesting mix, and have both chosen to then go with the more what the world would see as creative careers then, but what was it that made you, you must have taken at some point that leap?
Well, I actually worked, yeah, well, I did literally take a leap at one point, but this, I wasn't writing fiction. I was writing fiction for my kind of, just for my own ends at the time, writing short stories and never showing them to anyone because they were dreadful. But so after I finished my PhD, I did work for 4 years for Marconi, as was then. I don't know what they are now, they've various different changes of company. But in the aerospace industry, designing, I was doing mathematical modelling of radars and missile guidance systems. I did that for 4 years and I hated that job. I just didn't care about it. I just didn't care. And I would go in and do it, and it was kind of, and I was a well-paid graduate office job, but I couldn't stand it. And at the same time, I was still in bands at that stage, and I ran a fanzine for kind of underground bands and writing. So I was doing sort of makeshift journalism. I mean, it was literally fanzines before online. So we were like, you know, printing them off. My mate worked at a print shop, and we print them off and staple them together and hand them out in pubs and clubs. And I started to get things like pieces of journalism published in like the Edinburgh Evening News and the List magazine and stuff like that. And I just thought, look, I'm never going to make a go of it if I still have this, you know, day job. So I just quit. I quit my high paid graduate office job and became a freelance music journalist, much to my mum's disgust at the time. I'm sure she's still waiting for me to get a real job again. But but what was interesting about that was, I mean, I was busier than ever. This is, I mean, back in 1999, so a while ago. And you could just about make a living. But I was a freelance arts journalist, basically, for a few years. And I was busier than ever because I was hustling for work, you know, all the time, 24/7, instead of just doing 9 to 5 and switching off. But I was loving it. I absolutely loved it. And I was writing for a living. And I was, you know, interviewing bands and authors and reviewing gigs and shows and all sorts of other stuff. And I started to take my own fiction writing more seriously at that point, because I just, even though I was busier than ever, I just somehow found time to do that creative stuff as well. So that's really, it was 7 years between when I started as a journalist and when I got my first book published. So it was still a lot to do and a lot to learn, a lot to be rubbish at. But I'd start to give myself the permission to be rubbish at writing books. And hopefully I've got a bit better over the space of 14 years and 12 books or whatever it is.
So, something's going right, isn't it, Doug?
No one's found me out yet.
Next
week someone's going to find me out.
Yeah. Well, we all live there, don't we? No, I did my first job. I wasn't sure that I wanted to go to university. I had a disappointing A-level outcome. In fact, it's been quite a triggering week for me hearing about everybody on the news talking about devastated by their A-level results. I'm like, oh, God, I remember that. And I took a turn around the block. And my first job was for Lloyds Bank Investment Division. And I worked for a year for Lloyds Bank. And that's showed me that I didn't want to work for Lloyds Bank. and within that, and I was playing, you know, I was playing music, thinking about music all the time, and thinking, no, where can I find a space in the world now that I'm not protected by being a school age person anymore? Where can I find a place in the world where I can just keep being allowed to think about this and just keep kind of doing what I'm doing without knowing where that's going to take me in a way. And a music degree was important to me. And the one I found at City University, where I knew I'd have the chance to learn some different types of music, was fantastic. And I wrote some letters and persuaded them that I should be allowed to come to do their degree. And they said, okay, yeah, you can come. So I had that time. Since then, it's always like my sort of my pattern. It's always been more a sort of, how can I'm not finished thinking about this yet. I'm not finished wanting just to play or keep being in this world where I can just keep contemplating music and people. And it just sort of, I just kept going through. So I finished my undergrad and then and met somebody who turned out to be who was a supervisor. Who supervised my postgrad studies? And he said, "You come and work with me. Come to Cambridge and work with me." And I was like, "Ooh, can I?" So I had an amazing time then, I carried on playing the sitar, and alongside that then, so I was still studying, just having this chance still to dwell in this, just like, you know, it is ivory towers, but to dwell in this space of just thinking about and observing people and humans and their musical practices, and keep studying that. And I just loved doing that. But at the same time, I then, having been playing the sitar for some time, I got in on the books for a few different agencies that the basically sort of community music type projects. And this agency would find me gigs, and I would go into schools and do education sessions and about Indian musical forms and structures, and I would sort of teach some that part that happened to be on the school curriculum at that time, for which covered the like very sort of, well, problematically, but basically would sort of cover world music in a couple of weeks, in, you know, all world musics. We can cover all world musics in the space of 2 weeks and put that in the curriculum. But that was kind of what was there at the time. And I just found myself in a position that I could actually get paid really quite well to go and deliver these workshops in schools and for community projects. I didn't expect that would be a way of keeping sort of paying my rent, but it was for some time. I did sort of off, you know, random gigs. I would do a lot of wedding gigs with quartet work. I used to busk with my viola and play usually the solo Bach cello suites. They work really well on viola. So, and I found that I was very portable with that. I didn't need to take any, you know, I would play by ear or by memory. I wouldn't have to take any music paraphernalia. And importantly with busking, I wouldn't have to split the profits because there was just me. So the hourly rate was much higher than if I was playing with a group for that. But it was always just sort of patching together somehow, but not wanting to stop, not being willing to stop. But yeah, it definitely wasn't, you know, one year at Lloyd's was enough.
I think we've both got that experience of that idea of, you know, having a career path is just like nonsensical. I think the idea that, you know, you see this every year. I mean, it's a kind of cliche now about, you know, oh, I didn't get my A-levels, but, you know, I've done all right for myself sort of thing. But the idea of like, you get certain grades, you go to university, you get a job. I mean, I hardly know anyone actually in real life that's ended up doing that. It's less and less these days. I think that's how people's lives pan out. And there's always weird left turns or like you say, Nikki, it's just kind of that way of, oh, I've got another couple of years where I'm allowed to do this. And that's always the kind of way of like, well, how can I make ends meet doing something that isn't going to, you know, kind of destroy me? And that's basically what you end up doing, I think, very often.
What one word would you use to sort of summarise and encapsulate your object that you brought along?
Colour.
Okay, mine would be rhythm.
I feel like, yeah, those are quite easily explained as well, why you've chosen them. Right, Fab, well, thank you for coming along to talk to us today. I think we'll wrap up there. And I think we've gotten to a few very interesting places today.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thanks so much.
I want to talk so much more about music theory and creativity.
Well, we can, let's chat.
Thanks for listening to Sharing Things. If you enjoyed our podcast, then please tell your friends, colleagues and neighbours, and it might even be a good excuse for getting in touch with a university mate you haven't talked to in a wee while. If you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can find us on Spotify, iTunes, your favourite podcast platform, and we also have a website. Take care and see you next time!